What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
40 years ago, the world's first test tube baby was born.
Nowadays, we don't call them test tube babies anymore. There's been so many kids, millions, born this way. I'm Daniela Hernandez, and I'm the digital science editor for The Wall Street Journal. So in vitro fertilization, you can think about it as taking conception out of the woman's body. So you take an egg and you take a sperm and you put them together in a dish. Doctors do this process all the time, but back then it was really controversial. People were scared that kids were not going to be healthy. They were also afraid that they were playing God.
Scientists still have a lot to learn about fertility. It's kind of still in beta.
Because human fertility is still a black box, researchers are trying to feel their way around this space by looking in every nook and cranny, looking at factors that affect whether a woman miscarries or not. They're looking at ways that they can help males who are infertile because that's not very well understood. And then they're also looking way into the future to see whether they might be able to one day help same-sex couples conceive biologically related children.
The future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
I'm Michelle Kramer-Coakley.
And I'm Matt Kramer-Coakley.
And we are here in our apartment in Hoboken, New Jersey.
They got married a couple of summers ago.
About 3 months after getting married, we went on our honeymoon to Japan. And we decided that we wanted to start trying right after Japan so I could eat all the raw fish. And everyone says it takes a little bit of time. It either happens right away or it takes some time.
But they weren't getting pregnant. Michelle knew she didn't have fertility issues, so Matt got tested. But at first, even the doctor didn't believe the results.
And it was basically there was no sperm. And it's not totally uncommon, but it was rare enough that his initial reaction was they must have done something wrong with the test, because how could it be zero?
But the test wasn't wrong. A more thorough exam found just one, which on the upside meant he could at least make sperm. So he began taking drugs to up his count. Then more tests.
And so when they do the deeper dive analysis, they would actually take the sperm and they look at each of these like screens, and then they see whether they're moving or not moving and how healthy they look.
It was funny when Matt got his first test that had like a good result. He was waiting to tell me, and I had been out that night, and I came home and he's like sat me on the couch and he was like, so I got the results, and he was like, and there were 8 sperm. And I was like, okay, that's okay. He's like, 8 sperm, that's amazing. Like they're moving and they're happy and they're good and they're, you know, good sizes and everything.
I thought they were happy.
They felt happy, yes. But more importantly, the doctors felt like that was like a turning point and they were like, great, you can start doing IVF. Whereas everything else had just been like this waiting game.
We're sitting in front of thousands of dollars worth of IVF drugs, vials and syringes, and a small special disposal bin for the needles. Their insurance covers about 90% of the cost, but they've already paid about $5,000 out of pocket.
We're grateful for the fact that we can afford to an extent, and this is obviously something we want, but if this is 12 months down the line and we run out of the insurance money and we then need to spend $20,000 every time, that'll be a major discussion and question, and that's a piece that we're, you know, still optimistic and hopeful that we won't need to.
And not only is IVF expensive, it's hard. There's the uncertainty, lots of visits to the doctor, plus daily shots.
And Matt was my nurse, so Matt was the one who
It was very stressful for me.
But he did great. I would sit on the couch, I would play Beyonce, and I was like in my zen mode.
After about 10 days of all this, her eggs were ready.
17 of those were mature. They match those up with Matt's sperm.
Then at that point, they could do the embryo transfer.
They popped it on up there. We could actually see it on a screen doing an ultrasound. We could actually see them like shoot it in and you could see it like moving along.
But Michelle says she's not getting ahead of herself just yet.
They also, for instance, gave us a picture of our embryo. I'm not going to frame it. Like, I'm realistic that like this could go in the trash tomorrow.
For people like them, the next stage is waiting to see whether that embryo will stick. It's about a 50-50 shot.
Now, why are they not attaching? I am Ali Brivanlu, a professor of developmental biology at the Rockefeller University in New York City. We had no way in the past of trying to figure out what is the process underlying this. Does it come from the embryo? Does it come from mom?
Until recently, our knowledge about early development came from other animals, and that doesn't show researchers the full picture of what's going on in people. So he's working on synthetic human embryos.
Because they're not the natural product of sperm and egg, but they still have all the information to generate what is the closest approximation to a human embryo.
To make them, he uses cells plucked from real human embryos.
Those cells have a magical property that doesn't exist in any other cell that we know of in the universe, except one. It's a fertilized egg.
He's referring to their ability to develop into any kind of cell. Dr. Brivonlu places these stem cells on special microscope slides that have tiny circular wells on them. Here, he can coax them to develop further, and he found that they impressively self-organize into circular structures. He can make millions of these and test the variables that might affect whether an embryo is normal or not. He then analyzes the results with artificial intelligence.
It's almost like a mirror that reflects your past.
Scientists are excited about the possibility that such studies will give insight into the earliest moments of development. But there are also serious ethical concerns over tinkering with what many consider the beginnings of life. His team is also able to grow real human embryos for about 13 days in a petri dish, giving scientists a first look at how embryos might attach to the uterus.
And I can have my computers, my microscopes, my laser tracking every single nuclei of every single cell or every single gene of every single nuclei of every single cell and give you the exact sequence and choreography of what happens when things are going normally, they attach, and what happens when things do not go normally. We do this in collaboration with the IVF clinic, obviously, because they have patients who clearly have attachment failure.
He takes stem cells from donated embryos and uses them to make synthetic ones.
Because we can follow development from the first stages onward, we can now see exactly what is the program that goes wrong. At least in this one case, you can imagine that there are hundreds of reasons why something would fail.
And the research could have long-term medical applications after further testing, both in the lab and in the clinic.
The journey for a woman who's going through infertility treatment is really quite grueling, and it can often be somewhat of an ordeal for her and her partner to be going through. My name is Zev Williams. I'm the chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at Columbia University.
Dr. Williams works with people who struggle to get and stay pregnant. If you take Williams' average patient, she's had about 6 miscarriages, but he's seen women who've had more than 20.
What we do is really look carefully at each step. So to look at the uterus, at blood clotting, at hormones, at the immune system, and especially at the genetics to try and see if we could identify where there might be a problem that we need to fix.
If current IVF is a single one-size-fits-all recipe, doctors are working on something that's more like a cookbook, full of recipes. In other words, doctors are trying to bring personalized medicine into the fertility clinic.
The area of innovation, though, is looking at those for whom the standard protocols don't work and trying to think, how can we change what's currently being done to try to tailor the care for them?
He's referring to a new type of fertility treatment doctors are testing, where a woman replaces her IVF injections with a drug that she can take in pill form. The idea is to coax the body to produce more of the hormones that encourage egg production on its own. This method would also be much, much cheaper, about $200, compared to thousands. He's also beginning to test medication and methods that can help reduce the chance of miscarriage.
It truthfully is pretty amazing to think that pregnancies ever succeed.
These approaches are still in clinical trials. There's a significant number of people for whom current treatments just don't work, and doctors often don't understand why. Meanwhile, other researchers are studying male infertility.
My name is Polina Lushko, and I'm assistant professor at UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, at the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology.
Lushko spends a lot of time studying sperm, and what she's looking for is what it takes for one to find and fertilize an egg.
This is where we actually purify sperm cell because we receive generous donation from our human participants in those cups. And then we have to basically put the suspension of the sperm cell at 37 degrees in this incubator so they will swim out of their seminal fluid. And this is one of the samples. And then we let it sit and a sperm cell concentrate at the bottom.
This is what she does just to get sperm ready to go under the microscope.
The sperm cell needs some time to adhere to the glass, so you might not be able to see a lot of them. But as the time goes by, you will see more and more sperm cell swimming around. And here you can see for yourself.
The sperm honestly look like they're at a playground, moving, flipping, hopping. The reason to focus on sperm, she says, is that in most cases of male infertility, scientists don't know what's wrong. Sperm produce electrical currents, and that helps them move and fertilize eggs.
Depending on the intensity of this current can regulate dramatically sperm ability to move. So if we can measure those electrical currents, we can assess sperm fertility potential.
Up until recently, this wasn't even possible. These advances should help chip away at that majority of male fertility cases that remain unsolved, or where the science fails to provide helpful answers. But what can science do for people who can't produce an egg or sperm?
My name's Amanda Clark, and I'm a professor of molecular cell and developmental biology at UCLA. I'm a stem cell biologist, and I'm interested in scientific questions that are aimed at improving human reproductive and child health. So with human infertility now estimated to be around 10 to 12% of the reproductive age population in a developed country, including the United States, there is increasing need of couples to access assisted reproductive technologies in order to start a family. However, currently, assisted reproductive technologies require a couple to be able to make an egg cell or a sperm cell. But for those individuals that do not make germ cells anymore, there is no option for having a biologically related child.
Right now, Dr. Clark is focusing on the men.
Historically, it was always considered to be a woman's problem. Infertility is the problem of women. But actually, we now appreciate that infertility is found about equally between men and women. So it's been estimated that 30% of cases of infertility are female factor, around 30% are male factor, and the other 30 to 40% or so are combined subfertility between males and females. So this is not a woman's problem anymore. It's everybody's problem that we need to think about.
And the goal of her work is to essentially make sperm from scratch. Almost.
So this is my lab area here. You can see that this is the molecular biology side of our lab.
She takes us into her lab where they're studying something called induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, from humans and primates. That means it can become any cell in the body, just like how an embryonic stem cell can become a heart cell or kidney cell, but these don't come from embryos. Instead, scientists create them in a lab.
It could start with a skin punch biopsy that a scientist will take back to the lab, and then using proteins or RNA, a scientist can now turn back the clock on cells from the skin punch biopsy and make them into a pluripotent stem cell that is equivalent in function to an embryonic stem cell.
It means you can take an adult cell back in time.
Do we have any iPS cells?
I have iPS and PGCLCs.
Some aggregate cells?
So there's day threes.
What we make in our lab is something that is very young and is not at the point of a sperm or an egg cell yet. So I'll show you some cells down the microscope. What you're going to see is a ball of cells called an aggregate.
She shows us a collection of cells that look like a blob. In it, stem cells from primates are just beginning to grow into sperm cells. Scientists have already made synthetic sperm in mice, but in humans, this is still very theoretical. One application of this technology could be for people who become infertile from cancer treatment. For example, a man who's been through chemotherapy could use this as sort of an insurance policy.
If it turns out that he is infertile as a consequence of his chemotherapy, then there potentially could be an option for making his sperm cells entirely in the lab for use for reproductive purposes.
And it could be something for same-sex couples or non-traditional families to consider.
However, there are a lot of technical challenges that need to be overcome before this could ever be used for this type of reproduction. And in particular, we don't yet know how to even make an egg or a sperm cell entirely in vitro. I think that this conversation is really just at the beginning.
The way that people are thinking about making either an egg or a sperm from scratch is that they take this little tiny piece of skin, essentially, and they use that to reprogram those cells and make stem cells, which can then become any type of cell in the body. But what if the kind of cell you want to make is naturally in your body? So if you're a man, you don't have eggs, and if you're a woman, you don't have sperm. And so not only do you have to turn back that biological clock, but then you also have to reprogram it to have a capability that no other cell in your body has.
Can you help folks understand why this is such a big deal?
Well, I think if scientists get it working, the reason that they would be super excited about and the public would take notice is that because so you wouldn't have to go to an egg donor or a sperm donor or rely on adopting another child, you could have a child of your own. And I think that possibility would resonate with a lot of people. Now, there's going to be a lot of ethical concerns before that possibility is realized. Is it safe? Are the children going to be healthy? Is it only going to be available to certain people because of cost?
In our next episode, how criminals are using digital money such as Bitcoin and how law enforcement is scrambling to keep up. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Jordan Bell, Daniela Hernandez, and Laura Sim, with thanks to Kristen Schwab and Anthony Green. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Stephanie Ilgenfritz. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the newsroom in New York.
I know experiments can't stop for The Wall Street Journal. Sorry.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.